produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, VR Hoisington, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 370. Starship Trooper, including three Wakemans. Wakemen?
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 370 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast, and please do, via the various different ways on the site yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, Mark and I enjoyed watching Starship Trooper three times, with a different Wakeman each time. Listen on for the full story. We also tackle the tricky subject of the latest Cruise to the Edge in our twopence. Neither of us were there, so please do chime in if you were. On the Patreon group this week, Mark and I compared notes on the early chapters of Simon Barrow's Solid Mental Grace, listening to the music of Yes. The draw for next month's book club book, which is Stephen Lamb's Yes, Every Album, Every Song, will take place very soon. So if you'd like to be in the running for a free copy of that book, and you'd also like to help support the show financially, please do head over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for all the details, or click on the Patreon button on yesmusicpodcast.com. Around the social media this week, there was plenty to remark upon. On Facebook, Paul Watson spotted and shared a tweet from @bugglehornzTT, saying that Downes and Horn are to record a new Buggles number 40 years after Video Killed the Radio Star. Daniel Crone also spotted this and kindly sent me a message about it. As resident wit Joseph Cottrell pointed out, it's presumably going to be Internet Killed the MTV Star, or some such. Rising prog star John Beagley posted a video from his new double album, As If, and Trading Boundaries showed their latest Roger Dean set up in Palm Beach. That always sounds so exotic to me. Freezing here in little old England. I wonder if it really is. Uncle Preston Frazier has reached sign language from Keith's Ascension 2 in his detailed and epic review series, and I very much enjoyed the video taken by Fernando Perdomo I shared of No Opportunity Necessary, which is possibly the tune with the most misquoted title of all time. In the visitor posts, Jeffrey Mason added the louder sound interview with Steve Hackett, in which he states that he was asked by Chris Squire to join Yes. I slightly mischievously asked how many prog stars of a certain age were not asked to join Yes by Chris Squire at some point. Adrian Bell has a new episode of his prog show out, and over on Twitter, there was the usual deluge of interesting things, including @YFCCCYesHeadsYesPins, that's badges to us for UK folks, and @YesSolidMental, pointing out that Alan White has recently said in an interview that Yes will be producing a new studio album early in 2020. Hooray! I imagine that's scheduled to celebrate my 50th birthday. Only fitting, of course. Alongside the slightly puzzling news that John Anderson and Sean McKee, along with engineer Ryan Black, will be teaching an advanced class on mixing soundscapes in 5.1 surround sound. It says, in a Columbia College first, the project will be multi-departmental, creating visual gaming and virtual reality companions to the album. Okay. Jeffrey Mason also spotted Rick Wakeman on the UK Car SOS TV show, and many thanks to Kenny Brown for mentioning YMP. Simon Barrow pointed us to the track Crash Landing on Dave Kurtzner's new In Continuum album because it features John Davison, Steve Hackett and others. And over on Instagram, I shared the first two parts of my Yes birthday haul, badges and a promo copy of State of Play from Talk on CD single. Nice. As always, many thanks to everyone who got in touch this week, including those who left thoughtful comments on last week's show notes, Paul Tomei and Dave Watkinson. This week we're taking a look at three Starship Trooper videos because a highly unusual and odd thing happened to me a few days ago. While engaging in a bit of light-hearted badinage with the ever-generous and knowledgeable Keith Hoisington, he said something which stopped me in my tracks. I was creating a list of names who might take part in a Union 2 project just for fun, and I came up with Anderson, Howe, Kay, White, Rick Wakeman, Rabin, Horn, Mraz, Downes, Davison, Sherwood, Brislin, Pomeroy, Molino, Shellen, Dylan Howe, Oliver Wakeman, David, Koroshev, Jobson, Levin, Jones, MacDonald, Colbeck, Berlin, and of course with Bruford watching from the wings. However, Keith asked me to explain why I had left Adam Wakeman off the list. So I'll ask you the same question I asked myself at the time. How did I not know that Adam Wakeman had played with Yes? I've never heard anyone previously mention this, and he is never included in any of the lists I've seen of live players or other collaborators. So I did some research and found out there is a bit of an interesting story around it, which I've tried to piece together. You'll let me know, I'm sure, all the errors and inconsistencies in my version. In 1998, when Yes were assembling in the UK for the Open Your Eyes tour and particularly preparing to welcome me and my wife to our first Yes show, Igor Khoroshev apparently had an issue with visas in a foreshadowing of Steve Howe's More Drama, or not, depending on which story you believe. Our friend Henry Potts posted on Forgotten Yesterdays at the time and speculated around who might be going to step in for the band. He mentioned Jeff Downes as the favourite, interesting from today's standpoint, Patrick Mraz, Tony Kaye, Trevor Rabin, and here's what he says about Adam Wakeman. He says, "Call it a hunch, and I'm probably completely wrong, but Adam is currently in the country and available as far as I know, and he knows at least some of the Yes catalogue. But what put the thought into my mind is that he plays on a cover of Only for a Lonely Heart on Anderson's forthcoming solo album, The More You Know." So there we are, further proof, if it were needed, that Henry is a proper Yes soothsayer. The end of Henry's post is also worth noting. He says, "Who else? It probably has to be someone in the UK, which rules out most of Squires, White's, Anderson's and Sherwood's usual collaborators, which leaves Howe. There's Keith West, who's worked with Howe recently on In the Grand Scheme of Things, and one track of Symphonic Music of Yes, or Steve's son Virgil, who plays keyboards as well as drums. Julian Colbeck, additional keyboardist for the ABWH tour, is he in the US or UK? Or maybe they could go on without a keyboardist, with Sherwood handling most of the keys, perhaps helped by Anderson, White or Squire in places." Fascinating stuff. So, as is the long-held tradition for Yes, they needed to find someone really quickly to take Khoroshev's place if he didn't make it across the pond. So, flipping through their Rolodex, presumably, Adam Wakeman's name did indeed come up. There ensued the usual mad panic rehearsals, apparently in only one day, or I think actually probably a week, and Adam was preparing to play the whole show. Then Igor managed to arrive in the nick of time, after all, and Adam wasn't needed, but was invited to play on Starship Trooper anyway, in a generous move by the band. As current book club author Simon Barrow mentioned on Forgotten Yesterdays himself, nonetheless, Igor stood aside to allow him to play the Starship Trooper encore, joining him right at the end. It was a stellar performance, and they both seemed to enjoy the moment, a special end to a special evening. On Twitter this week, I asked Adam and Oliver about the event, but Brian Neeson responded with this. He says, "I broke the story to the Daily Record." Yes played Glasgow's a few days later. They printed their version, which included a description of Igor as the Big Russian, and a made-up quote from John Anderson saying, "It was eerie to turn round and see Adam, as he looks so much like his father." Interesting stuff. Thanks, Brian. I can't find a photograph of Adam anywhere in which he looks anything like his father, so I think your puzzled emoji is spot on. Pete Whipple, also on Forgotten Yesterdays, transcribed John Anderson's introductory comment from the concert. "This real wonderful guy came over yesterday afternoon and rehearsed with us the whole show. Here he is, Adam Wakeman, and he's going to play a song with us. Here we go." So on 26th of February 1998, Adam Wakeman joined Anderson, White, Howe, Sherwood, Squire and Khoroshev on stage as Igor graciously gave way for him. "We thought it would be fun to listen to, watch and compare the three Wakeman lads' performances of Starship Trooper. A song, of course, which none of them were originally part of, and I was delighted to find that a sound recording of Adam's unique version is available on YouTube, so I'm going to start with that. In common with our recent experiences of this tour, this song starts off in very fine form. There's an authentic Hammond organ sound from Adam, and the music swings in exactly the right way. Initially, the keyboard part is simply held chords, but it's integrated really well. Squire's bassline climbs deliciously, and John Anderson's vocals are on top form in this pretty decent crowd recording. All the instruments are full of vitality and Steve Howe is particularly full of energy, along with Alan White's drumming. Howe's acoustic section speeds away with the backing of Squire and Anderson's great vocal harmonies. The musical corners are well negotiated and I think I can even hear some fine rhythm guitar work by Sherwood in there. The keyboards have a principally accompanying role until the verm or worm section, which Steve Howe leads off with a lot of characterful artistry, as you'd expect. Squire, as usual, attempts to shake any remaining dust from the rafters with his enormous bass bombs, and the music builds up in a very pleasing manner. The band sounds and feels just that, a unit working together brilliantly. Squire's soloing is a melodramatic delight, soaring and punching through the texture, and the emotion is ramped up and up with Adam's keyboard bed growing as the harbinger of the solo to come, And suddenly we arrive with a tearing, searing Moog solo voice expertly wielded by Wakeman. It elaborates the central notion we have of the original in fascinating ways with a huge amount of dexterity and imagination. Those of us who struggled, or perhaps succeeded, in failing grade 3 piano can only listen in awe. It's a really good addition to the song, and when Howe takes over, it's turned out to be a satisfying passage from Adam. There isn't any guitar-keyboard dueling, but Sherwood does get a go at soloing as well, I think, in his adrenaline-soaked finale to the concert. It's perhaps a shame that Adam only got to take part in this one song, but he certainly acquits himself very well indeed. Let's leave the last words to Tarellan Millithor, real name, on Forgotten Yesterdays again. All that said, the guy who absolutely stole the show was definitely Adam Wakeman. He came on during the encore to replace Igor for Starship Trooper, and without wanting to seem sentimental or biased, his solo spot was the highlight of the evening. I was stunned. In awe of this lanky, long-haired prodigy who evokes thoughts of Rick in his youth, same build, style, energy, and complete genius. What a guy. So what of Wakeman number two? Well, we have chosen to watch a video from Lugano in 2004, where the band consists of Squire, White, Howe, Rick Wakeman, and John Anderson. This concert is from the 35th anniversary tour on which the fantastic Songs from Songus DVD was filmed, and this concert, which was recorded for TV, formed part of the Lugano Jazz Festival. I always find that slightly odd. Jazz? This certainly is not. Anyway, Rick adds a very similar wash of Hammond to Adam, and the band look very settled indeed, despite a couple of very minor timing issues. The music is laid back rather than energetic, but it seems to suit the music fine, and the band actually make this performance closer, perhaps, to the awe and wonder aesthetic of other later Yes music, which is interesting. It feels like a mature, almost spiritual take on the classic rather than the more frenetic performances of previous years. Anderson's vocals are fantastic once again, and the mix is really great. You can hear all instruments without anything sticking out, and Squire's bass tone is particularly pleasing. Howe is pretty stony-faced, but it doesn't affect his performance, which is great, especially when the finger-picking, acoustic-sounding guitar kicks in. In fact, by this stage he's using the multi-purpose guitar, which doesn't look to my uninformed eyes like an acoustic instrument, but it sounds just right. Anderson and Squire vocal duetting is lovely, very precise and in tune. It's impossible not to smile at this performance. It has a certain amount of humour, and the band is clearly enjoying it. Wakeman then adds some keyboard voices to support the Yes choir in the elongated follow and wordless chorus passage, which I was unaware of in the previous performance, although it might just have been inaudible in the poorer quality recording. It sounds good, however, and blends well. It really is a lovely performance, full of intimate spirit, and as we move into Verm, the crowd clap along, and you can see them doing so. Take note, ARW. Chris Squire has moved into his full-blown theatrical romping mode when Anderson moves to his percussion setup, leaving him to kneel at the very front of the stage delivering his solo while making the kind of connection with the audience that very few performers are capable of achieving. It's Freddie Mercury, Mick Jagger, industrial-scale playfulness, which I know some fans don't like, but I could watch it all day. No further proof is needed for me when I watch this. Yes has to have a bass player at the front of the stage, given equal status to all the other musicians to make it authentic. And then comes the Rick Wakeman Moog solo. Well, you'd expect this to be stunning, towering, and you'd not be disappointed. It's an original 70s instrument, and you can hear the analogue brilliance of the sound. I really don't know how he does it, but this couldn't be any other keyboardist. No one surely would argue that he does things nobody can match with this instrument. He knows just how to twist the knobs to combine the pitch-bending, shifting tonality with lightning-quick runs and screeching brilliance to produce an ever-fresh, if short, solo, which dazzles. This performance benefits from some rasping bass pedal and wonderful Howe soloing, all backed up by towering White drumming and pulsating Squire bass. What an ending, with Rick playing two keyboards behind him. Alicia Keys, are you watching? And a huge bash. It's raining hard in Lugano, but nobody cares. So finally we move to a very different period of Yes's multifaceted career, March 2011 at the House of Blues in Texas, on the Rite of Spring tour. Here we have Oliver Wakeman, Benoit David, Steve Howe, Chris Squire and Alan White. It's an audience-filmed video taken from a high vantage point. The sound is quite good and Benoit does pretty well above the band, including Oliver's almost inaudible chords. The stage is tiny and the camera is zoomed right in, giving a sense of intimacy. The song goes along well and Squire is certainly in good form. It's once again laid back but not stilted for me. It's a full sound and takes off again when Howe begins the acoustic picked section. David and Squire's vocals blend well together, and there's an amusing view of Chris towering above Benoit, in a shot reminiscent of Harry Potter and Hagrid, in some ways. It's lovely to see this raw footage of Chris reminding us of what we've lost. With the natural wood floorboards and the very informal setup, this feels like a bunch of musicians pitching up for a secret gig. And it's a great insight into the good times of Benoit's tenancy. He even goes back to back with Howe at one point, prompting a rare grin from the guitar maestro. Worm strikes up again, and the crowd are clearly loving it. There are quite a few recordings from around this time which feel lackluster, slow and plodding, but for me this isn't one of them, and it's a pleasant surprise. Even in the very restricted space, Squire is able to solo in a pleasing manner. Fewer histrionics, maybe, but it's still great fun as he sidles repeatedly across the stage, catching audience members by the eye. Finally, Oliver gets his go at that solo. His is a very different version with a lot of runs, and it's very interesting to see his finger work from this angle. One of the defining characteristics of great Moog soloing is the ability to use the monophonic restriction of the instrument as an asset. It requires great ingenuity and musicianship to create memorable and characterful solos when you can only play one note at a time. Oliver opts for more running passages than pitch bending and effects, and it works really well for me. His instrument sounds less earthy, less analog, but in no way less exciting as he employs left hand as well in some lovely and intricate ways. It's a great recording to have, which shows the height of what this lineup were capable of. They don't seem tired, as they did quite often in this configuration, and Oliver shows that he was a great asset. It gets a lot more energetic towards the end, and the mark of a great band is the ability to produce performances of this quality in a range of different situations and venues. I was very impressed indeed with this show. So for me, all three Wakemen, acquit themselves brilliantly on Starship Trooper. In the end, there's no one quite like Rick on the Moog, and his sons would be the first to acknowledge that fact. But they also do very well indeed, and Wakeman Sr. should be very proud that his DNA appears to have been pretty effectively passed on to Oliver and Adam. I've really enjoyed experiencing this Yes Dynasty at work.
Greetings, friends. So this week, we're going to be taking a look at the song Starship Trooper. As well as it being from three different time periods, we will be taking a look at three different keyboard players, although all three of them have the same last name of Wakeman. Starship Trooper is one of those songs that were performed by pretty much every keyboard player that ever came into the band. One of the most interesting things to look at is the fact that while Rick Wakeman is probably most known for playing this song, as well as Tony Kaye, his two sons also played this song. So the three people that we're going to be taking a look at today will be Rick Wakeman, Oliver Wakeman, his oldest son, and Adam Wakeman, the son that most people don't really know too much about, I don't think, mainly because most of his live experience has come from playing with people like Ozzy Osbourne, so that's a little bit out of the progressive circle, so to speak. Let's take a look at Adam Wakeman first. So Adam was involved with Yes for one show and one show only, which was the Manchester, England show on February 26th, 1998 at the Apollo Theatre. Now, the story goes that Igor Korishev was being held up at the border and having custom and passport or visa problems, was it? I think it was visa problems. Adam was asked to jump in to replace him for this show. As luck would have it, Igor made it to the show on time, but as a way to thank Adam, the band let him sit in and perform Starship Trooper with them on the encore. When taking a look at this performance, it's very interesting. He stayed very much to the original context of the song, very much sticking with the organ, as one would imagine. Nothing too surprising in the sense that obviously he had limited time to learn this and to rehearse it, so his smartest bet was to stick with the original way that the song was played. Where we see the differences between the three people are what they do when they're allowed to do their own thing during the solo break, during the Worm section. Now, Adam does a pretty interesting solo. It's a lot less flashier than both Oliver's and Rick's for sure. But he does show his progressive heritage, doing a few arpeggios here and there and some scales. He seems to kind of just stick within the basic chord frame that are happening during that solo section. He does do a little bit of pitch wheel stuff, which is nice, how he kind of bends the notes a bit. But overall, I find that Adam tries to take a very non-risky approach to this, mainly because I think that he probably didn't expect to play at all once he knew that Igor was back in the picture. I guess as a way for him to kind of show thanks to the guys, he didn't want to kind of pooch it on his end, so he probably took an easy track to it. and played it safe. But overall, it sounded fantastic, I thought. And for somebody who had such limited time to learn the song, I think he did a great job. Next, we go over to Oliver. And the performance that me and Kevin listened to was from the House of Blues in Dallas during the 2011 tour. Now, the one thing that kind of sticks out right away on this version of it is that the song as a whole is very, very slow. It's like crawling practically, which I have no idea why they played it so slow. Much like Adam, Oliver sticks to Tony's sort of original version of the song, sticking on the Hammond organ mainly. Unfortunately, I find Oliver's mixed a little low in this version of the song. But from what you can hear, you can tell that he's sticking pretty much to Tony K's version of the song. The Hammond organ sounds really good, though. He plays all the sort of accents that needed to be played very well on this. And again, the main difference that's shown here between the three Wakemans is when it comes to the solo. And when we get to the solo here, Oliver shows a little bit more tendencies similar to his father. A lot more flourishes, a lot of more arpeggios, and a lot of jumping octaves as well, which he does, especially when he does scale runs. He'll do a little scale and then repeat that scale up an octave or two higher, which is interesting, especially since a Moog doesn't make this very easy to do since it has a limited octave range. But if one notices, Oliver is using a much more newer version of the Mini Moog at this time. So it's obvious that he had more range on his version of the Moog than maybe his father did. Another thing that's interesting to make note between the both sons is that while they're pretty competent in using the Moog, they don't seem to want to experiment as much with it as their father does. If you notice, whenever Rick plays it, he's always twiddling a knob here and there, or he's fiddling with the glide switch, or he's always kind of experimenting with the keyboard. And that's something that I find that Adam and Oliver don't do very much of. Now, speaking of Rick, the performance we're looking at today is from the Luongo show from the 2004 tour. Now, this comes from a really fantastic show. That Luongo festival show is just fantastic. I'm very pleased that I have the whole show on DVD and watch it quite often. So Rick performs this song pretty much perfectly, in my opinion. All his organ parts are fantastic. Even though he sticks still within the basic structure that Tony K laid down, he improvises a lot more little parts in there, adds little extra little chords and notes, and does little punches and accents that are not on the original version of the song, which definitely makes this song more his style than Tony's style. And it's funny because a lot of times when people talk about this time period, a lot of people are surprised to hear that this isn't a song that Rick Wakeman wrote, because he plays it so much like it's a song of his own. Another thing that he does really well, I find, is Rick has a tendency of sometimes supporting vocal lines with the keyboard. And one great example of this is when we're coming out of the breakdown part, where they do the "you and you may follow," that line that they do at the end there. If you listen to it, he's supporting that follow note, that follow. He's supporting that. He's supporting that with the keyboard. That note, he's playing it and he's kind of almost following the melody line to give it some extra thickness to that whole section. And it works really well. He's very good at doing that. And then, of course, we get to the worm part. And what's interesting is, unlike anybody else, he even does a little improvisational part at the very beginning of that part, where usually it's just Steve playing by himself. Then when we get to the actual solo part, I mean, this is where Rick shines. His solos are always fantastic. He has such a great knowledge of the Moog keyboard that he can get so many different kinds of sounds in within that keyboard. It almost sounds like he's jumping between keyboards, and he's really not. He's just doing lots of adjustments with the knobs. And his playing is just great. Lots of great arpeggios, lots of great scales and techniques. And what I love is when he slaps in the glide switch, and those notes just slide from side to side. When he goes from a low note to a high note, you get that big swooping that comes in, and it just sounds fantastic. And this is something that most keyboard players, I think, got from Rick. He was the one who made that probably pretty popular. Him and maybe, you know, Keith Emerson. Also, he has a great sense of the pitch wheel. A lot of the times when he pitches a note up or down, He never pitches it flat or sharp. He always knows perfectly where to place these notes. And that's a very, very hard skill to come up with, especially if you've played a keyboard with a pitch wheel. Sometimes you'll find that if you don't do it properly, you can find yourself coming out of a note very sharp or very flat. So hats off to Rick and his fantastic technique. So that's my look at Starship Trooper with the three different Wakemans. Let's go and talk about it further with Kevin.
What fun we had listening to three different Wakemans, or is it Wakemen? I never quite know. Adam, Rick, and Oliver. And Mark's here with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Okay, thank you. I've said it several times in this episode, but I can't believe I never knew that Adam had played with Yes. Was that something that you knew about previously?
No, I was actually unaware of it as well until we started doing the research into this. And when I first read, you know, that we had to look into Adam Wakeman's performance, yeah, I was like, Adam, really? I didn't even know that he'd played with them.
Yes, indeed. And so Keith Oystenson was having a bit of fun with it. I think it was Keith anyway. Tell me if I'm wrong. Because he pointed out that we have three Wakeman, two Howe, I think, and two Anderson, and two Rabin, who've actually played with the band or performed with the band at some stage. Now, the second Anderson is, of course, Damien. And he was trying to find out, I don't know if he's ever found out since I spoke to him online about it, that Damien, in fact, popped up on the Tourmato and did that bit of Circus of Heaven. Now, Dave Watkinson said he went to some of those concerts, and certainly in the evening concerts that Damien didn't take part. But if you know out there that Damien did take part actually live, speaking those lines from Circus of Heaven, then let us know. That would be amazing. And of course, in terms of Rabin, Trevor Rabin's son guested quite recently on the drums in a concert of ARW, I understand. I'm struggling to remember his name. Anyway, it was very, very rude of us not to remember his name, but never mind. And of course, we have the three Wakemans that we're talking about today. And I suppose Adam is the least known, as you said in your piece, the least known to prog fans, but certainly not to music fans generally, because he's had an amazing career, hasn't he? Actually playing keyboards for all sorts of very high-profile bands.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was aware of Adam Wakeman as a keyboard player. I mean, not only from his long tenure with Ozzy Osbourne being his keyboard player off stage. Mm. But also I've, you know, with me and my Rick Wakeman vinyl collection, Adam's appeared on a few of Rick's albums, yeah, as well. So, yeah. I mean, I'm well aware of his fantastic skill behind the keyboards.
Absolutely. And that's shown in this. I mean, unfortunately, there's only a tiny little bit of Adam. It would have been fantastic if he'd been able to play that whole concert, but of course having Igor there would be better, because he's the guy in the band at the time, of course. So it was nice that they gave Adam the chance to play. So secondly, Rick, well, I did Rick second. I think you did a different order, but it doesn't matter. Now, the thing about Rick is it doesn't really matter what band he's playing in. You could always tell it's him. And I don't quite understand how you could always tell it's him when he's playing that Moog, whatever you want to call it. And I was actually fascinated, because I didn't just listen to this solo. I went back and listened to the one that he did on Yes Songs. And the amount of pitch bending and effects that he uses in this version that we listened to this week, totally different to that original way that he did it back, way back in the early 70s there on Yes Songs. He developed it a huge amount. He plays with it a lot more. It's a lot more elaborate. There are a lot more effects, and he plays with the pitch bending and that you mentioned, and the pitch wheels and all those sorts of things. So fascinating to see that Rick himself developed that solo quite a bit over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the main difference between the Yes Songs and now is that technology has greatly improved over the years. And I'm sure that Rick has a lot more outboard gear that he uses, you know, with conjunction to the Moog the other thing. So obviously he could affect it differently now than he could have back in 73 or 72 or wherever it was. But yeah, but even still, that's the one thing I've always been which I really enjoyed about Rick, is that he always found a way to take the Moog and just do different things with it all the time. He was always constantly going to knobs and turning them and doing this. And he never was satisfied with just leaving it on a setting and just playing, which a lot of people tend to do. He's the only guy I've seen in for years who just actually just has one hand on the keys and the other hand on the control board half the time, just turning something and moving something.
Yes, the other two Wakemans didn't do that anything like as much. Although I do think Oliver did a bit of that, but he certainly was using a very much more modern instrument in the video that we watched there. But yes, you're right. And Rick, I suppose that comes from the fact that Rick was one of those early adopters of this technology, this analog technology, as it was at the time. And he had to really develop from scratch, because nobody had seen these things before he started playing them, developed this style of playing, which created the whole kind of genre of prog soloing to a certain extent anyway. He was one of the exponents, the very, very earliest exponents of it. And of course, the instrument itself dictates how you play it, doesn't it? Because I think I'm right in saying, aren't I, that you can only play one note at a time. It's a monophonic keyboard, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's the, like you said in your piece, that's the benefit and the hindrance of the instrument, because you can only do one note at a time. And that forces you to think of creative lines and, you know, interesting melodies rather than having the advantage of playing multiple notes to make huge chords and pads with it. I mean, later on, they developed the Polymoog, which enabled you to do more than one note.
Yeah.
But he's always been a big user of this regular Moog version D, I believe it is.
Right.
It's just very... very much something that's signature to him. Like you said, he was in when it was first developed. So I think that's also why he knows so much about it and knows all the little tricks and things that he can do with it much more than other people. Because like you said, he was there from the ground floor and probably knows more about this instrument than probably anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And it reminds me also, of course, of the Mellotron, which again, it was one of those crazy instruments, wasn't it? I mean, it shouldn't have worked at all, having all those different tapes. Each note has a different tape running around, and it starts and clicks off when you take your hand off the key. It really shouldn't work at all, and practically never did, I understand, in live situations. But again, that had a particular sound and a particular way of playing it. And it's interesting that the genre, the sounds that we expect to hear in prog have been shaped by the instruments themselves, and not just the keyboard instruments, the other instruments as well, but particularly keyboard. Let's just talk about Adam and Oliver, though. Adam, least flashy, as you said, he had probably by far the least time to prepare, but I still think it was a well-defined and controlled solo, and certainly it was very well received by the attendees. I suppose you could argue, as you said, that he was to a certain extent playing safe, but still a really, really effective solo, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, you got to take your hat off to him, because the amount of time that he had to rehearse this. And, I mean, and we're talking about a Yes concert. We're not talking about, you know, like a Crosby, Stills and Nash concert. You know, this is something that's going to take a little bit more in-depth study of the music. And luckily, because he is a Wakeman and probably knows half of this music just because it's been around in his home probably half his life, he's aware of it. Probably made it that much easier for him to learn it. Still, it was not easy probably to come up with this stuff and to learn it. And like I said, I wasn't surprised that he had a more simplistic styled solo, but it was still very well played, sounded good. There was nothing wrong with it. There was no ill notes, nothing sour, no train wrecking. So hats off to Adam. He did a great job.
He did. It was really enjoyable. And I'm just so pleased that we've got a recording of it, because it could have just disappeared. It was only there for one song, and we have a recording of it, which I think is fantastic. Now, the Oliver one, I absolutely loved that Oliver one. I know you said it was slow, but I didn't think it actually mattered, because I thought it hung together well and the band were definitely all playing together as a real band, and Benoit David was singing really rather well, I thought, in that version. But the thing which was so remarkable to me was the venue. Now, that was from the House of Blues. I had no idea that the House of Blues was such a tiny venue, and reminded me very much of the videos from the Whiskey a Go-Go, that was what it's called, isn't it, that ARW went back to recently and played in this tiny venue. A very, very different context for Yes Music, and just like it did at the, it seemed to do at the Whiskey A Go-Go. I mean, I wasn't there at either of them, but it seemed to go really well there. And I think it's like those, you remember those unplugged MTV programs that they used to do way back? You could really tell immediately who were the musicians who were real musicians and really playing their instruments and knew what they were doing. And I think that came over in this video as well, that, you know, strip all the lights away and the scenery and everything else. You've just got the musicians. And I was really impressed.
Yeah. I mean, to make a note, though, that these House of Blues vary from city to city as far as how they look. I mean, I believe the New York City one looks really nice and fantastic. I mean, also refer back to the one with Igor, the House of Blues. That was a much nicer venue there.
Okay.
The one that did there. And this Dallas one, I mean, you know, they're only a few steps away from hearing a bunch of people going hee-haw and gunshots going off and, you know, sawdust on the floor. It definitely reminds me that that stage, especially, you know, like where's the mechanical bull in the corner or something, you know. But it's, you know, like you said, it doesn't, all those things don't matter. What matters is the music. And obviously they played it very well. But that was my only gripe, though. I just thought overall the whole song was a little slow in tempo. But at that time period, they seem to have been doing that with all their music. I remember a lot of people were talking about that, including us on prior episodes, that they were seeming a little slow in tempo. But, you know, that's something that's neither here nor there. His playing of the solo was very good. And he had a very much more modernized version of the Moog at this time, as we both mentioned. And, it definitely helped to give it a much more futuristic sound. I thought that his tone had a much more sci-fi feel to it than his father or even Adams.
Yes, indeed. And I thought that we're so lucky again to have that video, which was taken, I suppose, at random from that angle. So we get a really good view of what Oliver's doing. And yes, less experimentation live than, I suppose, both of the sons experiment a bit less live than their father, because Rick is the genius of the keyboard, and nobody's going to aspire to his heights of playing this sort of thing. This is absolutely his perfect vehicle for showing us what he can do, I think. I mean, yes, piano, absolutely, but this kind of Moog's solo, I think, is where he shines beyond anything else, possibly, with that. And you mentioned the glide switch, the fact that he can use that switch to just change the whole pitch of the whole instrument up and down, and it works, and he knows how to fit it in. And, you know, as the originator, he is the genius of this kind of music. So I absolutely loved hearing that. If you had to choose one, would you choose Rick's performance?
Yeah, absolutely. I think his is definitely the standout one. And I guess that whole Lugano festival that they played at, I think that whole concert overall was just absolutely fantastic. And considering that it was done in such a torrential downpour, is pretty impressive. And just a couple of notes I wanted to just throw in really quickly. You mentioned a stone-faced Steve Howe playing on that. And the reason for that, though, is John Anderson mentioned this in the documentary, that Steve Howe has a great fear of playing in rain. He fears electrocution. So I'm sure that came across his mind when he played that. So maybe he was a little petrified during that show. Another thing that you mentioned was the guitar that he used for the acoustic part.
Yeah.
He said that it looked like an acoustic instrument. It's called a Line 6 Variax, which is basically a guitar that you can switch into different modes and models of acoustics and electrics, so you can get those different tones. And one last thing, that show that we saw with Oliver, there are a couple of other songs that they have from that show, Complete, which is Close to the Edge and South Side of the Sky, which are also fantastic to see.
Excellent. Yeah, we'll definitely search those out. I do think we are really blessed to have all three of those to be able to look at them. And do go to the show notes for this week's episode yourself and watch those back to back as we did, because it was a really fantastic, really, really enjoyable experience this week looking at those. And please do put your comments on the show notes as well for this week and let us know what you think of those three Wakeman keyboard players. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're welcome, Kevin.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrein.
So, Two Pence, and Mark's back with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin.
So it's with a somewhat heavy heart that I do this Twopence this week. And it's based on some of the comments on social media and some of the reactions on social media to Yes's performance at Cruise to the Edge. Now, there is a tradition on Cruise to the Edge of doing a set list, which is pretty much based on the previous things that they've done recently. They don't seem to get out all the new material that they're going to do at, you know, the full Landlubber type concerts later in the year. They seem to start off with a fairly restrained set list. And I suppose the only real highlight of that for me, from what I've been able to see, I wasn't on the cruise, of course, was No Opportunity Necessary, which seemed to go extraordinarily well. And I absolutely loved seeing that video with Tony Kaye. I thought that was a great, great performance. However, quite a few of the people on the cruise, actually there, were not impressed with Yes. And some of the comments that I noted, which were fairly worrying to me, was that people were questioning whether Yes are actually the headlining band on the Cruise to the Edge. And a lot of people were saying that they actually go on Cruise to the Edge not to see Yes, but to see the other bands, which I thought was slightly worrying. But particularly some people that we know, and I'm not going to name them in case they don't want me to, but some people we know who actually left partway through the Yes set because they felt it was lacking in energy and they just didn't want to stay, which I think is a great shame. So what's going on? Let's have a title for our Twopence, which is Yes are overexposed and should do fewer live shows. I think we've actually talked about this before. So what was your reaction to those sorts of events on the cruise, Mark?
Well, I'm not really surprised, mainly for a few reasons. One, this is, as somebody else mentioned as well, and like we're not going to mention names, so but somebody else mentioned on here that this is the beginning cycle of another upcoming tour. They will be going to Japan soon to do it. And usually when you start back up again, like many concerts from many bands that I've seen, the first show sometimes can be a little bit troublesome, you know, and they need to get back into gear and stuff like that. And some people might argue and say, well, these guys have been playing for 50 years. Do they still need that much time to get back into gear? Well, yes, of course you do. You know, it's just like if you sit out, if you've been running every single day for 2 months and then you take a month off and then start running again, you're not going to be in the same shape as you were before, right? So, you know, but don't get me wrong. I'm not here to just defend Yes, because also there was a point brought up that I thought that was very important to talk about, is John Davison and him appearing on other people's shows and singing. I thought that was a mistake, I think, especially since they haven't played very much. For him to go out and, you know, sacrifice his own voice for other people's shows, I think was not a smart idea. I mean, one of them was for In Continuum with Dave
Kirstner,
sorry, that's it. And I know that Dave's a friend of the show and we love him a lot and he's a great musician, so I don't want to speak ill of him. But to have him to go and sing on his set probably wasn't a good idea, because he did sacrifice his voice for a Yes show, which I think is wrong. He needs to put Yes priority one and to put that kind of stuff on the back burner, you know. Do that afterwards, like do the Yes show and then do stuff like that, because, you know, people are watching. And just as we saw in those reviews, people didn't think that he had one of his best performances either. They said that his voice sounded tired, and that was probably from that, you know. So there's lots of factors that I think played into this disappointing performance.
Yeah, and I think probably you'll back me up on this, I'm sure. When I've taken part in small group situations, I've played a lot of chamber music in my time, string quartets and so on. If there's one person who isn't really feeling it and who's a little under the weather, under par, then that affects the whole group or band, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, not only just in performance, but I mean, if they're not into it, the mood is also obvious, and that kind of stuff can transfer to other people too, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there was mentioned that Jay Sheldon looked like he was half asleep performing there, you know. And, who knows what happened behind the scenes? That's always a thing that I try to keep in mind, being a musician myself, is that sometimes I played shows and people have come out to us and said, you know, oh, what a great show it was. And I would be surprised, because knowing what had happened backstage before the show happened,
yeah,
I was actually surprised that it went off as well as it did. So who knows what happens backstage? Maybe there was a, who knows? I'm just speculating. Maybe there was an argument, or maybe something happened. Maybe somebody got some bad news or something. Who knows what could have happened, but something affected some of these people in ways that were not good.
Yeah. And it reminds me, the story I always, or the parallel I always say to this is that when Pavarotti, the great opera singer, was reaching the end of his career, and he died quite young actually, but it's a shame, but he used to cancel more shows than he actually performed. And he was challenged about this, and he said, well, I'm Pavarotti. When people come and see me, they expect to meet me to be 100% and brilliant and, you know, the best singer on the planet. And when I don't feel up to doing it, I'd much rather cancel the show than perform, you know, in a subpar manner. So that's one way. That's one way to look at it, I suppose. But what about this question, Mark? Have they been playing too much? Is there a way in which a band can play too much? If you think back through the years, something like the 90125 tour was huge and went on for months and months and months and months. And they seemed to be performing well at the end of that. So have they been performing too much recently?
Well, I think the 90125 thing is a different circumstance. Back then, there was no internet. They played a long tour. They played many different cities, and you know, that was the extent of their why they were out for so long, because they went everywhere and played everywhere. It would seem, I guess, in comparison, that they played a lot more now, or maybe overexposed now. But in reality, I don't think that's the case, because maybe, in fact, they might have played more shows on the 90125 tour than they did now recently. But because of the advent of the internet and everything being filmed and everything being shown, we're getting flooded with Yes performances. Mm-hmm. And it would seem like they're playing so much, but that's only because we're seeing all these other shows. If we only ever saw stuff that was in our own town, right, then it would never seem that they were playing a lot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But because we have all this extra footage that we can see here, there, and everywhere, and plus, don't forget, they were on an anniversary year, so they were always in the news. They were always doing, you know, interviews, this and that. They did little acoustic performances with just the guitar and voice. There was all kinds of things going on, and they were playing extra shows probably because of that, because they wanted to celebrate their 50th anniversary.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. I think the internet has a lot to do with it. And it reminds me of the issue that comedians have, which is not directly comparable, I suppose. But comedians nowadays have suffered from the internet because, of course, every time they tell a joke, it's immediately broadcast to everybody else. And they have to come up with new material all the time. And I suppose, in a way, it's a bit like, yes, having to feel like they need to change the set list and but this is not what they've done this time. Maybe they're planning to do very different things in Japan. But it also reminds me of that argument that, in fact, if Yes had existed from 1968 to 1977, their legacy and what the general population or the population of music buffs think of the band might be very different, and actually might be viewed as a better band, having a better legacy, if they hadn't gone on and created that other music. If it was a bit more, you know, like the Beatles, if they'd stopped, never come back, and just had this body of great, great work in a particular style. So, you know, I think you're right. I think it is partly to do with the overexposure of the internet rather than overexposure of concerts. And that is that's got to be a concern for the band. But, you know, we need to see what happens in Japan. They're off there quite soon. I wasn't at this concert. The only footage I've seen from it I was very impressed with, because that's the only part I did see, is that one song, No Opportunity, which I thought was really, really well done. And it was very exciting, and I loved hearing that. So if you were on the cruise, let us know what you thought of the Yes performance. If you are concerned by it, that they're not going in the right direction, and a bit concerned by what you might hear in Japan if you're going then. So let us know on the show notes for this episode, and hopefully we'll be coming back reporting absolutely marvellous things from Japan. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're welcome, Kevin.
I've heard all Yes Music podcasts every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've heard all Yes Music podcasts every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
So just before we go, here's the patron update for this week. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, VR Hoisington, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And Yes Music patrons are Aaron Steelman, Bob Martellotta, Brian Sullivan, Chris Bandini, Craig Estenes, Dave Owen, David Hayden, David Pannell, David Watkinson, Dem, Fergus Cubbage, Fred Barringer, Jeff Bailey, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Sonic Bond, Steve Dill, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, H.P. Peterson, please do get in touch and let me know how to pronounce your name properly, William Hayes, Guy de Rome, Lobate Scarp, Mark Zykel Bags, Mark James Lang, Mike O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Peter Herndon, Rachel Hadaway, Robert Naser, Scott Colombo, Jeffrey Mason, Jamie McQuinn, Jeremy North, Jim, John Cowan, Martin Gelberg, Henrik Antonsen, Ian N.B., Lind, Ken Fuller, Keith Hoisington, Doug Curran, John Holden, John Parry, John Thompson, Joost Maglef, Joseph Cottrell, and Steve Perry. Also, continued thanks to Robert and David, of course. Thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them in helping to support the podcast financially and have access to lots of exclusive content and activities, head over to Patreon, patreon.com/YesMusicPodcast, or click on the link on YesMusicPodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week. In the meantime, do please follow the show on Twitter, on Instagram, or on Facebook. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.